Why then, as it is a periodic rotation, so must it carry, mustn't it, a vis centrifuga that might with some ingenuity be detected? Perhaps by finding, in the realm of time, where the loop tries either to increase or decrease its circumference, and hence the apparent length of each day in it. Or yet again, not rotate at all, the length of the day then continuing the same. Dixon, everything rotates. A vorticist, Lord help us, his mercy how infrequent. Emerson, believing vorticists to be the very legion of mischief, had so instructed every defenseless young mind he might reach. Very well, if you must know, lean closer and mark me. I have been there, sir. There, sir? Mason is gesturing vigorously with his thumb at the eye much wider than its partner that he uses for observation. Though I've ever tried not to recollect any more than I must, at least not till a zealously inquisitive partner insists upon knowing, yet the fact is that at midnight of September 2nd, in the unforgiven year of 52, I myself did stumble, dazed and unprepared, into that very whirlpool in time, finding myself in September 3rd, 1752, a date that for all the rest of England did not exist. Tempus incognitus. Eh? Don't say it. I didn't believe it myself. Not until it happened, that is, no discomfort to it, only a little lightheadedness. At the stroke of the hour, whilst I continued into the third, there came an instant transhalation of souls, leaving a great human vacuum as everyone else moved on to the 14th of September. Not sure what that means, of course. You'd have felt it as a lapse of consciousness, perhaps. Yet soon enough I discovered how alone 'twas possible to be, in the silence that flowed, no louder than wind, from the valleys and across those hill villages, where, instead of populations, there now lay but the mute effects of their lives. Ash-whitened embers that gave yet heat, food left over from the last meals of September 2nd, public clocks frozen for good at midnight between the 2nd and the day after, though somewhere else in the world, which had jumped ahead to the 14th, they continued to tick onward, to be rewound, to run fast or slow, carrying on with the ever-problematic lives of the clocks. Alone in the material world, Dixon, with 11 days to myself, what would you have done? Had a look in the jolly pitman, perhaps. A look of forbearance. I, as my first thoughts, were of the George in Stroud. Yet 'twas the absence of company that most preoccupied me, seeking which, in some desperation, before the sun rose, I set out, reasoning that if I had been so invorticed, why so might others? Breaking off abruptly, a word or two shy, Dixon by now feels certain, of some fatal confidence that Rebecca would have stood at the heart of. Young Charles was to reason eventually that the pain of separation had lain all upon his side, for she was to bid him good morrow upon the 14th, as she had good night upon the 2nd, without a seam or a lurch, appearing to have no idea he'd been away, cycling through 11 days without her. Nor had whatever he lived through in that loop caused any perceptible change in the youth she kissed hello the very next day in the High Street in Stroud, brazen as a bell. Meanwhile, there he was, alone, with the better part of a fortnight before he'd be hooking up again with his betrothed as smoothly as if he'd never been gone. And damme, he would be off. Were there yet horses about? Dixon wishes to know. Animals whose owners knew them made the transition along with them to the 14th. Most all the dogs, for example, fewer cats, but plenty nonetheless. Any that remained by the 3rd of September were wild creatures or strayed into the valley, perhaps being ownerless, disconnected as well from calendars. I found one such horse, a horse no one would have known, as well as two cows, unmilked and at large. I rode past miles of crops untended, looms stilled and water wheels turning to no avail, apples nearly ripe, wagons half-laded, the weld not yet abloom, nor the woad mills a-stink, till at length from the last ridge-line there lay crystalline Oxford, as finely etched as my eyes, better in those days could detect, nor holding a thread of smoke in it anywhere. You were making for Oxford? I, with some crack notion, I'd find Bradley there. Being a young Bradley-olator, as were all Lens fellows of that day, especially round Gloucestershire, though later, in my melancholy, I might see more vividly his all-too-earthly connections with Macclesfield and Chesterfield, and beyond them, looming in the mephitic stench, Newcastle and Mr. Pelham. At that moment, in my innocence, I believed that Bradley, our latter-day Newton, insatiately curious, must have calculated his way into this vortex, with the annoying question of why he should, kept beyond the gates of conscious entertainment. Did you find him there? I found something, not sure what. What surprised me was the sensible residue of sin that haunted the place, of a gravity, withal, unconfronted, unatoned for, lying further than simple Jacobite persistence. I'd of course collected, in some dim way, that Bradley had advised Macclesfield, his great benefactor, after all, perhaps even in partial return upon Milord's investment, as to ways of finding the movable feasts and holy days and so forth under the new style, and that Macclesfield had taken credit for the philosophical labor, as Chesterfield for the witticisms and bonhomie, that it took eventually to bring the Calendar Act into law. Yet though Bradley seldom sought a claim, preferring to earn it, neither would he refuse credit due him, unless there were reason to keep silence, such as the unexpected depth of his complicity in an enterprise so passionately feared and hated by most of the people. Both reached for the coffee at the same time, Dixon elaborately deferring to Mason's overriding need for any anti-stupefacient to hand. I don't know that in the entire cycle I caught a wink of slumber. 'Twere but a devourer of precious time, when all the knowledge of worlds civilized and pagan, late and ancient, lay open to my questions. Yet I guess I know this tale. 'Tis the German fellow, Faust, isn't it? But that he, at least, was able to live in the plenary world. I, alas, was alone. Eh? Well, as it turned out, not alone, exactly. I knew it. Some milkmaid out on a tryst, eh? Am I near it? Strayed too close to the vortex? Whoosh! Pale inverted, skirts a-flying? So, how did it go? Pray you, 'twas something I never saw. Certainly not Mr. Bodley's librarian, Mr. Wilde, and they were more than one. After nightfall, as I burned taper upon taper wantonly, only just succeeding in pushing back the gloom about me, would I hear them rustling, ever beyond the circle of light, as if foraging among the same ancient leaves as I. Mice or rats, maybe. Too deliberate, they seemed to wish to communicate. And this was down among those secret shelves where none but the elect may penetrate? You know about that? Of course. Emerson gave us a brief inventory. Aristotle on comedy. Always wanted to read that. All the good bits that Thomas left out of the infancy gospel. Shakespeare's tragedy of Hypatia. What saved me, impassively on, was hunger. An abrupt passage of indecipherable Latin returning my attention at last from lighted page to empty stomach. I recalled that pantries and wine cellars all over the town lay open to my hungers. Apprehensive, light-headed, I rushed from the library, too a-tremble to keep a taper lit, up ladders creaking in the absolute dark, down corridors of high bookshelves. Presences lay everywhere in ambuscado. I dared not lift my eyes to what all too palpably waited, poised upon the ancient ceilings, winged, fatal. Then, a sudden great whirr at my face. Scientifically, no doubt, a bat, though at the moment something far less readily named, provoking a cry of fear as at last I broke out into the open air of a quadrangle, yellow in the moonlight. Wait, that's it, the moon. Indeed, among any amateur astronomer's first questions, how should the moon behave, seen from inside this vortex? And? Ever full, ever fixed upon the meridian. An insincere chuckle. Yes, 11 days of light remorseless, to be faced alone in a city of gothical structures that might or might not be inhabited, whilst from all directions came flights of the dark creatures I hoped were only bats. I don't mean... as the timbers, nearly human, of the ceaseless howling I hoped came only from dogs. Not, oh, and more. 'Twas as if this metropolis of British reason had been abandoned to the occupancy of all that reason would deny. Malevolent shapes flowing in the streets, lanterns spontaneously going out, men roaring as if changed to beasts in the dark, a carnival of fear. Shall I admit it? I thrilled. I felt that if I ran fast enough, I could gain altitude and fly. I would become one of them. I could hide beneath eaves as well as any. I could creep in the shadows. I could belong to the devil. Anything inside this vortex was possible. I could shriek inside churches. I could smash every window in a street. Make a druidic bonfire of the Bodleian. At some point, however, without human prey, the evil appetite must fail, and I became merely melancholy again. Thee abandon thy studies of the ancient secrets for a mere tickling of thy sensorium, done with how swiftly? Mason, dear Mason. In fact, Mason unmirthfully, I was prevented from ever returning, exiled from the knowledge. As I crossed into the courtyard before Duke Humphrey's, I encountered a barrier invisible, which I understood I might cross if I willed, though at the toll of such spiritual unease that one step past it was already too far. What that influence was, I cannot say. Perhaps an artifact of the vortex, perhaps an infestation of certain beings invisible. I received, though did not altogether hear from somewhere, a distinct message that the keys and seals of Gnosis within were too dangerous for me, that I must hold out for the promises of Holy Scripture and forget about the texts I imagined I'd seen. I didn't want to hear that, I guess. Mason seizes, cradles, and hefts his abdominal spheroid. Meditating upon bodily resurrection, I arrived at the idea of this being resurrected, and without delay proceeded to a Bacchic interlude in which you'd not be interested, being too prolonged and, besides, too personal. Well, now, gone was the chance that might have changed my life. It lay at the eye of that vortex. To cross the flow of time surrounding it, was I obliged to aim a bit upstream or towards the past in order to maintain a radial course to the center? And there, whilst with Taurian stubbornness thou kept at it? Well, now, odd as it may seem, soon as I'd penetrated the barrier, I understood my holiday was over. I tried to pull back, but too late. I was in the vortical emprise. To my relief, some, at least, of the dark presences that had caused me such apprehension proved to be the wraiths of those who had moved ahead instantly to the 14th, haunting me not from the past but from the future, drawing closer, ever closer, until first I heard the voices of the town. Then, at the edges of my vision, blurs appeared, and movement, which went suddenly a whirl, streaking in to surround me, as in the mesh of prolonged faces, only hers stood firm. And when I joined her again, before I could think of what to say, she kissed me and declared, "Somebody got in late last night." The only proof I had that 'twas not a dream was the bite I received whilst in my noctambulation of the city. This life, runs the moral he is able by now to draw for Dixon, is like the 11 days, a finite period at whose end she and I, having separated for a while, will be together again. Meanwhile, must I travel alone, in a world as unreal as those empty September dates were to me then? Bite, Mason? Nothing, nothing. Likely a dog. How likely? What else? If the people of Stroud, pursuing ordinary lives 11 days ahead of me, could morphose to such sinister beings, why not their dogs? Show me. Well, that was the rum thing, Dixon, for about 10 minutes later. Hey, I am the sniffer sniffed, as Parker said when he put his head in the bear's den. Chapter 57. Early in 1766, new style, reversing the directions taken the year before, Mason sets off southward to see the country, whilst Dixon, mentioned in the field book only upon Mason's return as having left Philadelphia upon the 18th of March to meet with the commissioners at Chestertown, in fact heads north for the lighted streets of New York. At a theater with no name, no fixed address, this night happening to be upon Broadway, printing no handbills, known only by word of mouth, Dixon, upon the advice of a fairy companion, attends a stage performance of the musical drama The Black Hole of Calcutta, or The Peevish Wazir. Before a backdrop of Fort William, executed with such an obsessively fine respect for detail that during the work's longueurs, with the aid of a glass, one may observe, pictured upon the tableau, subordinate dramas as if in progress. Meetings of the management, hands clutching throats or leveling pistols, farewells by the landing, the steaming, pale, forever unreachable Hoogly and the ships waiting to go away, leaving behind the unspeakable, a corps of 24 ladies appear, strolling about in quasi-Indian dress and singing to the, as some would say, inappropriately lively accompaniment of a small orchestra. In the black hole of Calcutta, one scarcely knows quite what to make of things they groan and mutter, why 'tis cheerier in the gutter. Being dark and, ooh, so stuffy, little sugar for one's coffee, and the natives rather huffy, and the pillows far from fluffy. Ask of any Bengali, how's the black hole tonight? Don't expect him to be jolly, for there's something not quite right. As the lamps begin to sputter, all will not be scones and butter. When the door has at last been shut to that black hole of Calcutta, la la, la 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 la, la la. The story, as near as Dixon can make out, is about a British officer whose rivalry with a comically villainous Frenchman for the affection of a nabob's daughter brings on the war in Bengal. There are some catchy tunes, and an elephant promised in the first act, which, incredibly, at the very end of the show, is delivered. The audience sits stunned in the vacuous purity of not having been cheated. The elephant, within its elaborate trappings of red, blue, and gold, watches everything carefully. Someone's elephant, perhaps, but no one's fool. Girls emerge from the howdah in impossible numbers, wearing costumes as variously hued as the rainbow and as diaphanous. They place their stocking toes precisely upon elephant pressure points, long known to Chinese healers, strung along his ear meridians. The elephant rolls his eyes appreciatively. 'Tis this part of the show that the girls as well enjoy the most, or so they tell Dixon afterward when he wanders backstage to see what might be up, in all innocence following the sense of womanly exertion to the dressing room. Here he is. Took him long enough for a kid he got up so flash. Oh, you'll bore him, Fiona. Come over here, my darling. You can sleep later. Ooh, cow. Anyone in here for a turtle feast? My foolish lad has a coach waiting. Dixon is swept in a rush of polonaises, sacks, and petticoats into the vehicle, and with great cheering away they clatter, out the Greenwich Road to Brannan's, and an unsequenced 2 days of revelry, ever punctuated by someone rising to cry, I haven't felt this excited, turning to the others who roar back, since Eyre Coote won the Battle of Wandiwash, being a famous moment from the comedy, party ending up back in the town at Montaigne's Tavern upon Broadway near Murray Street, which proves to be headquarters of the local Sons of Liberty, as well as thick with intrigue, regardless of the hour. He is soon aware of Captain Volcano, who in the year since Mason saw him has been well in the crucible of the troubles attending the Stamp Act. Some of the old gang have fled. Others have decided to gamble everything unto their lives to see the British gone, though beyond this there is little agreement. Even if this act is repealed or in practice never enforced, any ministry of this king, even one that somehow includes Mr. Pitt, will be certain to tax us. It is our duty to resist, though it take up all our days and nights as well. The communications are now well established, despite British interceptions. We do well. More and more are resolved, our numbers ever growing. For the first time, we had a trans-provincial congress here in October. Yet the expense, reckoned so far, must be borne most heavily by the warmer sentiments, for we are become a colder lot. Tell your coadjutor he was lucky we caught him last winter, and not this, or Blackie might have had his way. From what he'll be pleased to hope a safe distance, then, Mr. Mason sends his compliments to your niece. She ran off with an Italian wagonsmith, the captain shaking his head, and they went to live in Massapequa, up on Long Island. His mother is teaching her to cook. Mason will be perplexed. How do you think we feel? A sort of club at whose gathering she might meet a possible husband. That's all the use we ever were to her. Politics? Oh, she may never care about any of this. The road's not for everyone. It's all it is. Hello, Captain. This one's a likely one, hey? A muscular, untended, dark cloud of an individual has appeared upon Dixon's starboard quarter. No, Blackie, he's another astronomer. You recollect the one last year? Well, this is his partner. May we, Dixon sweeping off his hat and making his notion of a bow. You hate English bastard? Want to kill them, eh? Ha, ha, me too. Much rather kill you, sighs Blackie, but as I meant, you shall have to stand me a pint instead. Seems fair, though by now broad daylight outside, in here 'tis forever midnight. Resolutions proper to the hour being made and kept all round them. Windows shuttered, lamps few. Good thing I'm a jolly straight-ahead lad, Dixon reminds himself, or I'd start to imagine all kinds of things. To the 66! Pewter clanking, ale spilling and commingling, much of it upon the clothing of the company. What do you think, then? Blackie asks abruptly of Dixon. Not Philadelphia, is it? Nor Boston neither, Blackie assures him with a clap upon the shoulder, though it little matters. Aye, every province is agreed in this business. All speak as one. What a terrible thing that British government should misread us so, when we wish to believe in their wisdom, their better grasp of history, as of secular likelihood, yet they will keep finding ways to nourish our doubts. Will their stupidity prove beyond the reach even of Mr. Franklin, our American Prometheus? Why bother to educate them? The stupider the better. Yet too stupid, and the only choice left is battle. There's the ticket, cries Blackie. At the peak of the riots, Blackie was running about 1,000 sailors, remarks Captain Volcano. And they're still in town, Blackie, with an eager nod, thanks to Captain Kennedy, who, in command of HMS Coventry, is regulating traffic in the harbor, allowing ships to enter, but detaining as many as he may who attempt to leave with their clearance papers unstamped. Here comes one of my lads now, in fact. Who does it prove to be but Foretopman Bodine, once of the Seahorse, who, as he now relates, having jumped that ship in Madras, watching from shore as she sailed away to the capture of Manila, had then hired on to a China ship, which was set upon in mid-ocean by pirates, who took him to South America, whence he escaped, making his way north among typhoons and hurricanoes, jungle and swamp, alligators and boas, Indians and Spaniards, till fetching up in Perth Amboy in the company of a certain Roaring Dot, Belle of the Harbor. Woman of my dreams, Fenderbelly vilely chuckling. Naught but a snotter waiting for a spirit, his lady controverts him. Happened to be this'n's all. Saved his arse from a musket ball before Fort George in November. Aye, Blackie all agrin, what a night, thousands of us. A fierce wind coming in off the harbor at our backs, sparks from the torches flying everywhere. Blackie kept imagining his hat was afire, recalls the captain. All shouting up at them, liberty, daring them to shoot. Buggers. Though Mayor James could have taken easily 1,000 souls at the first volley, he held his fire, and our war with Britain did not begin. But good Fender could have provoked it if anyone could. Whilst he was exposing his hind parts to the gaze of those in the fort, prudent Dot, recognizing signs of trouble ahead, removed a sap from her stocking and bestowed the pajefinous tarry memento from which he did not awaken until the next day, by which time he'd been conveyed to her barge at the Amboys. Well met, friend, says a quiet voice at Dixon's elbow. I'll not tell if you won't. Peering through the smoke, he recognizes Philip Dimdown, now as unmacaronical as possible, a serious young man upon a mission whose end may not be predicted. They make their way to a corner with a clavier, from whose top Dixon must remove a Madeira bottle, two cold chops, and a severely tattered periwig, in order even to lounge against it. So, thou art not a fop after all. I may pass fop remarks, make fop jokes, without giving offense? Was the best way to get by them, Dimdown causing his tankard to nod amiably. Rattling quite discomposes these Brits, some of whom may go for weeks without saying any more than they have to. Yet, as no true macaroni would, in non-macaronic company, behave too macaronically, in that was the impersonation you saw defective. That is, I might have been more subdued about it. Fooled me for fair. I was probably indulging fop sentiments long kept under, unknown even to myself. Yet even a son of liberty needs to have a little diversion, given that scarcely a day passes when one doesn't have to step lively if one wishes to remain attached to one's arse. And for me, say, being a fop's just the ticket. Right now, I'm obsessed with wigs. I find I have to change them once a week, at least, in order to remain unidentified. What think ye of this one? Just snatched it up and threw it on, in town but for the night. Been traveling about in a French bomb catch taken in the late war, La Fougueuse, two mortars in the cockpit, spot of bother with the trim in any kind of chop, dates back to 42, but she gets us where we want to go. She gets us round the communications, seeming by this to denote the total ensemble of routes by which messages might in those days pass among Americans, by which selves entirely word-made were announced and shared, now and then merging in a plasma, like the oversoul of the Hindu, surging to and fro along the lanes, from hillside to bluff, by way of lantern flashes, transnoctial hoofbeats, sharpies and snows, cryptograms curled among macaronic wigs, songs, sermons, bells in the towers, hat brims, letters to the papers, broadsheets at the corners, criers at town limits facing out into the unknown in the dead of winter, in the middle of the night, and shouting, never without the confidence that someone is listening somewhere and passing the message along. Upon water, as upon land, La Fougueuse in company with ferries coming and going round the clock, linking coastal Connecticut, New York, the Jerseys, all up and down Chesapeake, a single great branched creature, impulses traveling creeks and coves at the speed of thought. Virginia, the Carolinas, well into and beyond the mountains, into the water prairie of Ohio, and thence. 'Tis vast, Blackie assures Dixon, ain't never been nothing like it. Been living in Brooklyn all my life, seen some shit some English gents wouldn't even know if they stepped in it. And by then, 'twould be too late. But what's going on with these lawyers? Pollicating the captain. Hey, yous don't want to know. It's vast, all right. Know what I'm saying? Vast. Dixon, shrugging, shakes his head to indicate ignorance upon the topic. Christ's return, he guesses. That's next, after us. Is there paving the way? Very likely put, sir, cries an ecclesiastical-looking personage. I should add, inspiringly, but for the preponderance of deists among us, whom Christ makes uncomfortable. They will have their day. And later, a generation or two from now, when the people are at last grown disenchanted enough, 'twill be time for Christ to return to the hearts of his own. Why, Asaph, hold ye, and you they... You're a damned Voltaire reader yourself. What kind of thorns and angel stuff is this? Mr. Dixon, being a Quaker, can hold little love for any king, Blackie. Do calm down a bit. Though his love for Christ may be another matter, and 'twas that I was deferring to, that's if you don't mind. Course not, Blackie replies with the smugness of one who believes he has scored a point. Though reared a friend, Dixon feels he must clarify, I was exposed at a receptive age to a rush of deistic thoughts, aye, very deistic indeed, all in a great tumble by way of Mr. Emerson of Herworth, so I've a sentimental foot in each, as I'd say. As a Quaker, you'd surely rather see us independent of Britain, inquires Mr. Dimdown. 'Tis not how British treat Americans, Dixon amiably rubescent, 'tis how both of you treat the African slaves and the Indians native here that engages the friends more closely. An old and melancholy history. My allegiance, as a Quaker born, would lie above all tribes with Christ. Withal, as a Geordie, for reasons unarguably tribal, I can have no sympathy for any British king, not even one who's paid my wages, bless him. Call me an ungrateful cur, go ahead. I've been called worse. Hey, lo, thy jack's empty. Can't have the, allow me, all who are dry, no problem. Mr. McLean shall enter each into his ledger, and in the fullness of time we'll all be repaid. Aye, then, here they come. How can he with those great foam tops on em? What do they call the? That is a head, Blackie quizzical. They don't have that back wherever you're from? What kind of ale drinker are you then, sir? Shall we quarrel after all? Innocent question, Blackie looking about for support. Very well, as I did ask, I'm a faithful and traditional ale drinker, sir, who does thee a courtesy in even swallowing this pale, hopped-up, watered-down imitation of small beer. Far preferable, replies Blackie, even if slanderously and vilely untrue, to that black, sluggish, treacly substitute for naval tar, sir, no offense meant, that they swill down over in England, with a look that would have been meaningful, could it get much beyond a common glower. Dixon sighs. Ale loyalty is important to him, as part of a pact with the youth he wished to remain connected to. He lifts and drinks, as calmly as possible, the entire pint of American ale without pausing for any breath. Having then taken one at last, "Oh, error," he cries, "how could I have so misjudged this?" Blackie is as short of time as anyone here. This thing that is now taking shape has an inertia that may yet bear all before it. He can no longer indulge himself in what once, not long ago, would have proved a lively contest. Nowadays, all energy, all attention is claimed by futurity, unwritten as unscribable, the door wide open. Thus, I once took joy, as a matter of fact, in many a British pint, recalls Blackie, and go ever in the faith that so I shall again some day. Meanwhile, as with our tea, we brew American. Believe I'll have another of those, replies Dixon. Would thou join me? Chapter 58. Upon the roads of Mason's journey south, the scene is alarming. In Maryland, in September, the mob had pulled down the house of Zachariah Hood, who, refusing to resign as the province's stamp distributor, fled to New York and was granted refuge in Fort George in time to witness Fort Topman Bodine's bilunar exhibition. Though 'twas now possible to clear vessels out of Chesapeake ports unstamped, pleading a lack of stamps, Maryland was somehow among the last of the American provinces to do so. As if, having paused, self-amazed at their bold deed, the mobility were now considering their next step. As autumn rusted toward winter, youths went careering along the high roads, firing long rifles from horseback at any target that might suggest a connection with stamped paper, puffs of breath and smoke decorating the way. Groups of farm girls stood at crossroads and sang to them, "Americans all." Their fathers, not always with better things to do, offered jugs and pipes, and their mothers tea. Traveling sons of liberty never had to pay a farthing for drink, and were ever the objects of suggestions that, for even the liveliest of them, would have taken more time away from their itineraries than duty would allow. Massachusetts Bay accents were heard for the first time out in the Allegheny, up in the coves, or coves, as folk there were pronouncing it, pursed as the Yankees were broad. New Yorkers in Georgia, Pennsylvanians in the Carolinas, Virginians everywhere, up on horses, perhaps better looking than suited to the work, all took time to appreciate the music of voices from far away, yet already unmistakably American. Out in the field, down by the sea, the hour has pealed, whoever ye be. Daughters of Aaron, Scotia's son, let us be daring, let it be done. It is time for the choosing, Americans all, no more refusing the cry and the call, for the grain to be sifted, for the tyrants to fall, as the low shall be lifted, Americans all. Till the end of the story, till the end of the fight, till the last craven Tory has taken to flight, let us go to the wall, let us march through the pain, Americans all, slaves ne'er again. At Williamsburg, Mason, as well as being invited to the College of William and Mary to inspect the philosophical apparatus, is introduced at the State House to a party of Tuscarora chiefs upon a mission to bring out the last of their people from the Carolinas and conduct them safely back under the protection of the Senecas, where they will join the rest of their tribe, the sixth of the Six Nations. The escort have some apprehension about crossing Pennsylvania with 100, perhaps 200 Tuscaroras, for they have heard of the Paxton massacres. But along the way they are to be joined by protectors from various nations, principally Mohawks. Though their territory lies hundreds of leagues to the north, the Six Nations are ever a bustle through the forests of Pennsylvania, observing all movement, regardless of size, vigilantly. Any of Paxtonian disposition, Mason tries to reassure the chiefs, being usually blessed with a marksman's eye, know who's in the woods and why, yet will not at every opportunity choose to engage. He is staying at Mr. Weatherburn's. One morning a note appears tucked into a frame full of crossed ribbons from Colonel Washington, in town and seeking a quiet game or two of billiards. Their tranquility is not long preserved as more and more arrive in Raleigh's billiard room round the famed great table. Even as clearings appear in the smoke of a tavern, so in colonial matters may we be able to see into, and often enough through, the motives of Georgie Rex and that dangerous band of boobies. Henceforth, it seems, the Irish and the Ulster Scots are to be upon the same terms with them as the Africans, Hindus, and other dark peoples they enslave. And so, to make it easier to shoot us with all Americans, though we be driven more mystically, not by the lash and musket, but by ledger and theodolite, all to assure them of an eternal supply of cheap axemen, farmers, a few rude artisans, and docile buyers of British goods. Not only presuming us their subjects, which is bad enough, but that we're merely another kind of nigger. Well, that's what I can't forgive. Are you sure? Civility, sir. The word you have employed here in this quiet pool of reason is a very shark, which ever feels its lunch hour nigh. Excuse me, do I hear that word again? In this smoke, 'twould seem so are we all. Washington grabbing Mason. Colonel, sir, twitching away, 'twould be far preferable. That voice, Mason, 'tis my tithable, Gershom. And furthermore, here's the latest news of the king. Several hoots and whistles. King goes in a tavern. Bartender says, what'll it be, George? King says, I'm in disguise here. How'd you know who I was? Bartender says, that crown on your head. King says, only a madman would walk around wearing a crown. Bartender falls on his knees. Your Majesty. Half the company seem to believe this is a white customer impersonating an African. Others, having caught Gershom's act before, recognize him right away. Hey, Gersh, do the one about the crocodile that can talk. The rabbit in the moon. Wait a bit. Somebody say there's a real Negro in here? Hell, maybe even more than one. For the rest of the evening, everyone suspects everyone else of being Gershom. Now and then, someone, though the bellows are never quite fast enough to reveal who, tells another King joke. King's alchemist presents him with a filter that can transport him wherever he wishes. Mason's turn to put the clutch upon Washington. Baby Fizz, Nath McLean, or I'm a sailor. King decides he'll journey to the sun, the invisible youth continues. Alchemist says, Your Majesty, the sun, it burns at thousands of Fahrenheit's degrees. Far too hot there for anything to remain alive. King says, So where's the difficulty? I'll go at night. Young Nath, back in classes at William and Mary, daily more woven into continental realities here, seen through what he and his schoolmates style the room broom, appears already less fit, more slothful than the narrow and restless camp factotum of the summer previous. I left that party just in time, he confides. I should have been crazy as Captain Zhang had I remained a week more. Crazy enough, remarks his friend Murray. That bad, was it? Mason, a bit reserved. All respect, sir, the captain wasn't just pipe-smoking in the article of that Shaw. We all felt it, as to appearance, did you and Mr. Dixon. Surveying a property line, that may be one thing. Clearing and marking a right line of 100 leagues into the lands of others cannot be a kindly act. Should we have refused the commission, then? Mason, in ever-sharpening nasality. We didn't invent parallels of latitude. Your dispute is with Hipparchus and Eratosthenes before him, both, I believe, dead. Perhaps no harm will come of it. So must we pray. Remember me to Mr. Dixon, your servant, sir. As Nath once more is subsumed into nicotic vapors opaque as futurity, leaving Mason feeling guilty as foolish, unable to rely as much as before upon remembrances of the cheerful boy who passed like a shuttle, ever to and fro and amidst, as if weaving the very party on into the west, day upon day. Chapter 59. The surveyors return to the North Mountain at the end of March to find the Shelby seat engulfed as ever in turmoil. 6 neighbors, having but lately petitioned Governor Sharp to remove him and his coadjutor, Mr. Joseph Warford, as justices of the peace, the captain's secular woes have multiplied sensibly toward a state of irremediable chaos, owing to the great scandal over the winter involving Tom Hines, Catherine Wheat, and their baby. You recall how last September, not long before you boys arrived, Conrad Wheat, one of our distillers hereabouts, girls Catherine, goes up before Captain Price, holding in her arms her newborn baby, swearing under oath that Tom Hines is the father. She doesn't appear at November Court in Frederickstown, so the matter's put over till March. Tom wonders what she's up to. Some other swain behind the smokehouse he don't know about? He's all perplexed. His own father is happy to advise him. This is my grandson. Know what that means? No, sir. A grandson means a man can quit worrying at last. Means the chain goes on unbroken. The miracle of fatherhood. That's as long as the little sucker's daddy ain't some contemptible fool who'd gladly run away, but for his own father, who'd beat him so roundly he'd be running nowhere for a long while, of course. What? Tom agape. Marry the bitch? We dwell among people of the kirk, lad, advises the elder Hines, recalling the sampler your dear mother made that hangs o'er the hearth. Expect Indians, nods Tom. Exactly in the same daily spirit must a man, aye, and woman too, at every moment expect lawsuits out here from any direction, for any reason or none. In a Presbyterian world, 'tis best to keep a tidy life. Marry her. She'd never have me. Proving she's got good sense. All the more reason why you need to marry her. Now tonight, I'm going to lock you in this shed here. Dad. Tonight, Tom, you must be sober and alone with your soul, not out rowdy dowing. Take note, I've been holding back the hickory so far. This is too important. Think about it. So young Hines obeys, though his thoughts aren't quite as spiritual as his father might have hoped for. Rather, Tom, through these dark hours, slowly pieces together what, even in the sunlight of the next day, to his reddened eyes, continues to look like a clever plan. Forget the bitch, he announces. We'll seize the baby, dashing off before William can comment, to call upon Captain Shelby and ask him, as peace commissioner, to write him a warrant to repossess the baby. The captain, hearing the story, is amused. His blood gets to racing at the possibility of yet another lawsuit. He goes through a great rigmarole with good paper, pens, and inks of several colors, and wax seals as well, and Tom, who can't read any of it, figures he's as good as got that baby in his hands. That Monday night, about 9 or 10, they go to serve the instrument. Tom and the constable, along with Moran, Dawson, a couple of others, Nathan Lynn and John Gerlow, show up at Wheat's house, pretending at first they only want a quart of whiskey. 6 of them, they're planning to share a quart? The German, suspicious already, now spies Tom Hines among the company. A pint I can only sell you. Well, come on out here, Conrad. We want you to look at something. Conrad thinks about it. There are women and children in the house. His nearest pistol is too far away. He shrugs and steps into the night, leaving the door open a little, with only the thrusts of light from candles inside, moving to and fro to see by. We've come for the baby, Conrad, says the constable, Barney Johnson. Will you give him up? Why should I? Court order. May I see it? Too dark. Read it to me. Barney sighs. Here, Moran, you've the lantern. What Shelby wrote proves to be a search warrant for stolen goods, more of the Welshman's peculiar notion of mirth. Catherine pops out the door to remind the constable that her child ain't goods, stolen or however. Tom, jumping down off his horse, goes after her, and she slams the door in his face. Everybody's feeling edgy. Who signed this order? Conrad shouts. Don't tell him anything, warns Tom in a temper. Tom, 'tis all legal, says the constable. And Conrad, now, the warrant is Captain Shelby's, but... Shelby? Some court order, Barnett. Shame so. Captain Shelby's demand, more of his bullying, it means nothing. My daughter has already given security to Justice Price, and her child is safe here. Catherine Wheat, having failed to show up in Justice Price's court last month, Constable Johnson, in a small, hurried voice, proclaims, is deemed in violation of the law, and pending disposition for the good of the child, must I order my deputies to lay hands upon it forthwith. Lay hands upon this, cries one of the girls of the house, and shakes out a great wing of dishwater, whose pinguid embrace not all escape, whilst another sets the hounds who live in the back upon the party. The house, of a sudden, is seen to be filled with more people than anyone might have imagined. Why then, Conrad, I am personally saddened to think you would lie thus in wait for us. The constable, unable to finish his thought, as he must struggle to remain atop his mount. Out the door, and a window or two as well, come Barkley, Steed, and the Rush brothers, Brooks and Flint remaining within to see to the ladies, advancing upon the constable's men, who, with backcountry whoops, come a-charging, cudgels ready to strike. Tom, in his not altogether subdued way, screaming, "He's mine, bitch, and I'll have him dead or alive." One of Wheat's boys, roughly pushed, falls, is hurt. A sister swoops in to snatch the baby and bring him in his swaddling, looking like a little stuffed cabbage leaf, back to the kitchen, whilst the others in the house shut and bar the door, though not for long, as the rioters close behind begin breaking it in. The boy has a compress of arnica tea upon his thumb by now, and will be all right. Conrad has a lot invested in the door, which he's carpentered, carved, and hung, all with his one set of hands. He watches, not yet able to believe that these men he thought he knew could become a band of raiders who mean him harm, and his grandson as well, it seems, for now in this ear-battering kitchen melee, the baby has suddenly become a ball in a game, being tossed in short, high arcs from one party to another, about the house, as the Shelbyites go beating upon anyone in their reach, injuring some so badly they won't make it into court. No more hazardous than the usual North Mountain wedding. Young Tom is beating the mother of his child, informing her, in a voice not entirely in his control, of his intention to kill her. Passionate lad, though not in any way women are apt to find welcome, is it? Nathan Lynn grabs the baby and runs out the door, then one of Wheat's women, chasing after, gets him back, runs on into the field with Barney after her and John Gerlow close behind. They catch her and beat her till she gives the child up, all out in the dark where they can't see her as well as they could back in the candlelight. They've no sense of depth here and don't know how hard to strike. All are phantoms to one another. At last, she reclines in a frozen furrow, weeping, trying to get one of them to look her in the face. Gerlow will not, and Barney is too occupied with the baby, who, upon assessing the constable, has begun to cry. Well, cry is perhaps not it exactly. All the way to Ralph Matson's house, that little banshee lets out a protest that echoes for miles off these hills. Irish folk cross themselves, needlewomen drop stitches, not to mention bow. For the days then teetered round us all, comments Captain Shelby. We'd soon enough ourselves be upon the march from Fredericktown down to Annapolis, riding as a troop, two and three abreast, with inexpensive comparisons made to the Paxton boys, though 'twas the stamp dispute that brought us out, and whether the assembly would pass its journal. Tom's domestic drama gave us a practice run, as you'd say, for acts of public necessity impending. At last they convey the goods successfully across to Matson's upon the Pennsylvania side. Captain Shelby's there waiting with Will Hines, the baby crying to chill the bones of Pontiac himself. Give it here, Barney, says the captain. You're doing that all wrong. And takes the baby, who abruptly falls silent, gazing up at the captain's eyebrows. Aye, you like that, do you? Can't say you look much like a Hines. Just as well. He orbs one by one the bleeding, disheveled escort. Do I take it the mother was unwilling to give the infant up? I made the Dutch bitch's blood fly, Tom Hines informs the company. Say it three times quickly, Tom, and we'll believe you. That, incidentally, is the exclamation verbatim, Uncle Ives here asserts. See proceedings of the Council of Maryland for the year 65. Your uncle has been telling the story as deposed much later by people wishing to have Shelby dismissed as a peace officer, perhaps to get even for some wrong committed during the crisis attending the Stamp Act, or perhaps more ancient. But here he crossed the line, a Pennsylvanian raid upon a Maryland farmer. Was more than whose warrant should have effect where. Shelby ignored the power of the line and chose to defy it, so it became a matter for Annapolis. Is all there, allows the Reverend, the whole squalid tale, transcending the usual neighborly resentment tied into that strange rising of spirit throughout the countryside, from a certain cock of the hat to the refusal of all further belief in boundaries or British government, a willed departure from history. Captain Shelby's personal peeve is the lack of respect for his signature upon writs and orders, which he seems to run into at every turn, either side of the line. The law, in its majesty, can look after itself. 'Tis the disrespect for him personally that Shelby cannot abide. Damn the Dutchman, he'd better stay over there in Maryland, or he'll be well thrashed. Refusing my writ? Good thing I wasn't along with you, Barney. I'd have burned his house down. No one reminds him that he wrote the baby repossession order in jest. He refuses, in turn, to accept security from Flint and Brooks on behalf of the Wheat girl. If my writ means nothing over there, why should your security mean any more over here? Taking instead the Hines' note for £100 as bond to keep the baby off the parish. The captain's troubles are not over, for now Conrad Wheat brings suit over the riot at his house, obliging all parties to show up at Justice Warford's house for a hearing preliminary to court. Tom Hines, the merry bachelor, though bobbing cork-like as ever, beginning to feel remorse, no longer alludes to his recent bloodletting activities. No one wants to hear about it anyway. When the moment to appear before the justice arrives at last, he's all but desperate to see Kate. Shelby comes in a bellowing after a warrant for Catherine Wheat's fine. Mrs. Warford advises against it, replies Joseph Warford, her gifts in this area being widely known. And Evan, don't try to squeeze this one dry, for there's not that much in it. Dammy, Joe, my old colleague at law, his worthy wife at whose table I've ever been happy to dine, betrayed. Who'd have thought it of either one here? Hey, Will. Hey, Tom. Tom? Tom Hines is not immediately visible. Amazingly to all, Mrs. Warford and a resolute candle flame reveal the North Mountain Casanova retired to a stuffed chair in a dim corner, with Catherine Wheat upon his lap, whilst he strokes her intently. You wounded me, she is advising him. I was bleeding. I've the marks yet. Here, can you see my back? 'Twas but a willow switch, and you were curled up so tight, I'd never harm you, Katie. Why, you lying snake, of course you would, and you did. How was I supposed to feel, everyone staring, without even telling me first you just went to Captain Price? I believed it our own secret child, the secret of our love, though no one need know. Are you crazy? Hide a baby? You know what babies are, yet. You've been in the house with ours for even a minute. What secret? Well, maybe I know that now. Maybe I was young then. Maybe even foolish. Then was 3 months ago. You could have just married me then, saved us all this. She doesn't care by now who thinks what, not even Tom, who she is looking schlag in the eye. Firmly propelled from behind by his wife, her version of a suggestive nudge, Mr. Warford abruptly enters the tête-à-tête, rumbling, Hines, as you have spoiled this girl and taken her credit from her, you ought to marry her. Both young people regard the avuncular apparition and the bobbing arc of faces behind with strangely calmed expressions. She rests her head upon Hines' shoulder, exhales, and continues to gaze at the company, her face, if not smug, then at least innocently relaxing after a long struggle. So, Tom, a confidence in her voice he's never heard, but were he quicker, might have felt concerned about, what do you think, my boiled potato? Oh, his face draped in a slow daze, I haven't much against it. Sure, I'll consider it. Intending to offer 25, but moved by the spirit of the room, Conrad Wheat declares, ye shall have 30 pounds from me, and a 5-pound wedding, so. Hurrah, cries Mrs. Warford. Now, when were you thinking of, young man, exactly? When? Tom Hines, not sure what today's date is, notes with some alarm that all this whole rioting, baby-snatching, litigious time, it has been Christmastide. Has Christmas come and gone, and he's missed it in all the commotion? Before year's end, Mrs., he supposes. Just a minute, cries Captain Shelby, who's been busy scribbling. The merriment subsides. There's yet this matter of the girl's fine. Joe, if you'll not write me a warrant, perhaps you'll at least kindly sign one of my own here. Mr. Warford peers over at his wife, who for the second time tonight de-superpolicates with a mischievous though unwavering smile for the captain. Sorry. I don't know how much more, as a man, I can really take of this, mutters the Welshman. Damn Dutchman with his 5-pound redottos and his Indian corn poison. Oh, much too grand to comply with my lawful writ. And now, old Joe, you refuse me once and then again. This night am I thrice denied. Then, dammy, I'll sign it myself. There. Now someone seize the young lady forthwith. My pleasure, cries the dim Tom Hines, clasping his sweetheart, who squeals. Will Hines frowns at Shelby. What new thievery's this? I'll take your note happily, Tom, the captain prompts. Dad? I think he wants you to be here for the wedding, explains Will Hines. Before the year is out, intones Mrs. W. Thus, upon the night of December 31st, all are gathered at Mr. Warford's house in clean clothes and hopeful spirits. Snow drifts in the corners of window panes distant from the fire. Mrs. Warford has made a great, dark, spirit-soaked fruit cake and iced it for good measure in bridal white. Conrad Wheat has brought a wagon load of his lately run Kanawha's White, whose drinking requires close attention, lest it prove but one more way of falling asleep. Stamp Act rumors fly among small gatherings of young men, in and out of doors. An assortment of calathumpians are there, with a full battery of cowbells tuned to the pentatonic scale, drums with possum skin heads, whistles and gongs, and a military bugle found in the woods after Braddock's defeat. Not as cold as last winter this time, do you remember? Cold enough for me. Never hope to see another like that one. This morning my dogs wanted to stay in. Your dogs have to lean against the wall to bark, Gus. Captain Shelby recites the service as if it were poetry. Will you, Thomas Hines, take Catherine Wheat to your lawful wedded wife? Aye, sir, I will. And Catherine Wheat, Thomas Hines, to your lawful wedded husband? I will. Then, barring some further act of disrespect toward yet another signature of mine, acting within my authority as officer of the peace, I am delighted to be able at last to pronounce, "Jump, dog! Leap, bitch! And I'll be damned if all the men on earth can unmarry you." Tell 'em, Captain. Oh, Tom, you've broken my heart, and several others as well. The fiddler raises his bow and attacks the black joke. Feet rediscover steps that are their own and not those of the day and its demands. When Tom wakes next morning, only slowly recognizing the bed Mrs. Warford is charging him 5 shillings for, the first thing he notices is the wallpaper, patterned all over with identical small blue flowers upon a ground of glowing vermilion. He lies there for a long time in the crescent light, doing nothing but regarding this floral repetition. He finds that if he comes close enough to the wall and lets his eyes drift slightly out of focus, each blossom will divide in two, and these slide away to each side until recombining with a neighbor, and that the new-made images appear now to have depth, making an array of solid objects suspended in a quivering bright ether. It may have been a difficult night. Only one or two things stand out. He does recall Captain Shelby performing the marriage. He looks over beside him now, and sure enough, there's Katie asleep, with an egg-shaped drop of sunlight about to touch her shoulder. So that was real. He also recalls getting up in the middle of the night to piss and being confronted with a figure he at first imagines as the devil because it bears a pitchfork, but which he presently recognizes as Captain Shelby. "Been waiting, Mr. Hines. Thought you'd never come. Look at them. They're all asleep." In every dark nook lay revelers under and upon the furniture and stairs. "All except me. I'm the only one who stayed up, for I knew you'd try to escape. Now get your arse back into that chamber, and if you dare to leave your lawful wife, tonight or ever, this," waving the fork, "gets jobbed into your guts. Are we in agreement?" "Captain, all's I got up for was to piss, and I was thinking more of outside the judge's house than in." "Why didn't you say so? Come on, then. We'll see. We'll go piss in the snow." Threading their way among snoring celebrants, trying not to blunder onto drooling faces or disarranged skirts, they go outside and together piss in the snow. Shelby writes his name sweepingly, as if at the bottom of some blank and all-powerful warrant of the winter, whilst Tom draws a simple heart, unpierced, unlettered, whose outline he fills in carefully, completely, and then some. The captain looks over. "You certainly did have to piss. Hallelujah. Attend me. Give up the pleasures of town. Those brick defiles are not for you. Your fate lies rather to the west. When those surveyors return in the spring, they'll be needing hands. You can be head of Shelby's men, a sort of party within the party. What say you?" "Did me a service," Tom Hines will declare when anyone asks. "I'm forever obliged to the captain. Catherine Wheat is the best thing that ever happened to me. Without her, I'd be lost. He sure knew what was best." They are reluctant to quit the freezing night. Tom asks quietly, "May she come along?" "She'll be in foal again, hey?" "Forgot about that." Shelby regards him silently and at length. "I had ye calculated for a renegado. Why, you're going to be another damned grandfather Cresap, Tom. You'll see." Chapter 60. In the strong twilight over the mountains of Wales, draining of light league upon league of darkly forested peaks, to the eye familiar, the occasional interruption of a cabin or plantation, chimney smoke, a gray patch of girdle trees amid the green pervading, a shade ascending one hollow at a time. The wind acquires at the dark a potency it did not possess in the light. An axe-bit's blow quenched in living wood. A dog after a squirrel. A percussive sandwich of hammer, anvil, and the work between. Night over all this watershed, how vast, that covers each soul in it like a breathing mouth, humid, warm, carrying the odors of living and dying, that takes back everything committed upon the land that day without appeal, dissolving all in shadow. They have caught up with this era in the settlement of this West. Though not in all ways insane, yet Captain Shelby, avid for any occasion to quarrel, exhibits signs of mania upon the topic of land disputes, being often preoccupied from well before sunup till far into the early darknesses with litigations great and petty, engrossments ditto, with boundary issues a particular passion. A fallen tree, a wandering chicken, the meanders of a stream, any pretext, any least scent of inconvenience will do. He admires this west line for its great size, though he's puzzled as to why there can't be a few angles someplace to accommodate a close friend, for example, or even more than one. Kings, Mason, with a what-can-we-poor-sheep-do look, which Shelby declines to join him in. This is how they reason, in map-sized sweeps of the arm. Divide it thus, I command you. They can't be bothered with the fine details. Having inked a map or two, I know that impatience, though my sympathy reaches no further. Out here the king has few to count upon, and his troops will be fools to come much past Cumberland. You be certain to tell him I said so. Tell whom? Whoever may be asking. Do thou believe we're spies, Captain? Dixon, with genial tap-room menace, moving as if into range. Sirs, I've been out here since before the late war, and have offered my hospitality to many a spy of every persuasion. For as spies must travel, so it follows some travelers must be spies.